Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and it's about tying these things and ideas together, or actually the content we're reading kind of goes hand in hand with this stuff. As I basically said, and as the bell clearly is tolling for me, as we look at what they're discussing as far as citizenship, and as we kind of look at what's going on in the political arena regarding elections, as we look at what else is going on regarding the undermining and the destroying of our nation within by people who claim to be citizens, by people who are being granted the privilege of being able to engage in our form of government and having say and representation in our form of government, and demanding that their representation actually violates their oath of office as they are equally violating their oath as a citizen. If you're starting to see the bigger picture, one can start understanding the beauty and the simplicity of being a citizen in this. I don't think it's that complex. We were kind of ending the show yesterday that if you can understand, you know, the automobile and how it functions, basically the combustion engine and the transmission, drivetrain, spinning of the wheels, and how the physics involved in moving a vehicle, whether that be on the water, whether that be in the air. I mean, I understand, you know, aerodynamics and lift and all of that is maybe not taught to people. But most people can understand because we've been driving cars for over a century, well over a century now. We have been in this government for almost 250 years. This is the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. And in 12 years, we will hit the 250th anniversary of the Constitution. 11 years. And so, folks, is this really that hard? I don't think so. And so what I want to impart is that when we start looking at where our problems are lying, it stems, so I could easily say, well, where does this stem from, Tammy? Where does this stem from, Sean? But just to get to the point so we can get into the content, it stems from us because of our ignorance. As I stated in the last show, as Thomas Jefferson asserted, ignorance of the law is no excuse in any country. As a matter of fact, our education system is deliberately failing us to ensure that ignorance so that they can continually pretend the government that they've created, and they're going further and further. I mean, we're at the point, as I also pointed out yesterday, that in 1821, John G. Jackson was saying, hey, you know, we're off the rails here, and this isn't making sense. We need something to help us understand, because what we're seeing coming from the courts, what we're seeing that the government is doing, these things are not constitutional. We're not seeing this as within the bounds of the Constitution. And they've wanted, and they asked Madison so that they could understand the Constitution better. They asked for his notes on the Constitutional Convention to please give them a copy so that they could suffer through them to basically have a better understanding. And as I told you yesterday, Madison, who consistently, since the ratification of the Constitution and all formal documentation, had consistently pointed to the ratification debates. Go read the ratification debates. He even read the ratification debates in Congress when they were talking about challenging or violating the Constitution, and he read them, and guess what? Congress still violated the Constitution. There was no true mechanism for Madison or the ability for him to go out to the states and go, do you understand what's happening? It didn't get to that point until 1798 when the people could tangibly see that their rights were actually being eroded because they passed a law that said you couldn't speak out politically in the Alien and Sedition Acts. I think it would have been kind of hard taking the debate. And actually, let me kind of welcome back Tammy and Sean that we're, you know, doing this. And the question for both, one or all, is, does it make sense that had Madison and Jefferson taken the argument to the people on the constitutionality of creating a national bank, that would have been one of those things that, you know, would have, I don't think it would have been too hard, but I think just due to the literacy of the people, the ability to read, not everybody could read and so forth. So taking something like that to the people would be, well, you know, the people may not be that moved to say, you know, hey, we got to stop this. Does that make sense? Sean?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Sean, what do you think? Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
So when it comes down to in 1798, when they said, hey, we have to step in here. We need to, you know, take back or undo these laws that are taking our freedom of political speech and the press and these other things. That makes sense, right?
Yep.
Okay. So, to me, I think that that's something tangible that the people could see, that, you know, they'd say, okay, that affects me. I think history, we actually have the proof and empirical data that when government gets to a point to take more and more money out of your pocket, if you have enough taxpayers left in your state where they're saying, hey, we're pushing back, stop taking our money, that affects them directly. You know, when a state has gone too far, because I'll give you an example. California and Washington State and probably New York, all of these dark blue states are really turning red, communist, red, blue, if that makes sense. They're literally going after the, you know, income tax, the makers. They're trying to take all the available money that they possibly can get away with. In so doing, a lot of people have left California because California started this trend and New York started this trend a while ago. And they started creating these income taxes or greater taxation burdens on millionaires, called the millionaire tax, and those types of things. And, I mean, if you look at the state of New York or the city of New York, I think New York believes it's a state, but if you look at the taxation that they're putting, they're basically saying you can't even sell your property without our permission. You can't leave our grasp. This is how bad it's getting. Folks, if you do not understand what is going on, then all you need to be informed of what's happening in these states, because it's coming to you. Just like, you know, DEI came to you, just like transgenderism and dysphoria. It's all coming to you. So as we look at, you know, the trends, what ends up happening first is people start to leave because they see their property being taken from them. They see their property being marginalized because government stops actually protecting your property. When illegals move onto your property, they say, we're not going to move them. You know, they've created a little niche. Now they're a homestead on your property. In other words, they're allowing your property to be adversely affected by people breaking the law. So what really is the telltale sign that the state government has gone too far is when corporations start abandoning the state. The corporations that were all on board for the progressive agenda to a point, all of a sudden the straw that broke their back was, now you're taking our profits, and we can't have that. And so the mass exodus is starting with Washington State. It's already started with both New York and California. You can just go through the history over the past 10, 20 years. How many corporations have been lured out of California? You would think by now they would have actually been, help me out here, destitute. But no, that's not the case. because the states are being paid billions of dollars from whom? To support most of the socialism that they're inflicting upon everybody, that is actually rewarding the takers, or for more people to be converted into takers. That makes sense, right? Because when you see how everybody gets cared, you know, that you get your health care covered if you can't afford it. But if you do afford it, you're paying through the teeth. And so more and more people are just saying, you know what, I'd just rather go on welfare. I'd rather be a dependent of the government than to fight this system. And or people are moving here who are absolutely, I'll just say, leeches. And look at what they've done in Minnesota. Look at what they're doing in all of these blue states by defrauding people, billions and billions of dollars. And they're getting more and more people to become participants in, I don't even say the fraud itself directly, but I would say it becoming a taker, becoming a dependent of government. Because, oh, now we need more of these programs to support these people. Now, there's a lot of people that stand up, you know, hey, you know, the people that need to be taken care of first are veterans and so forth. I mean, we're actually taking sides. We're finding ways to create a conservative progressive when it's not a conservative progressive problem. Government has no business being involved in this form of welfare and in doing these things, in pumping. So the reason these states aren't in such financial drift and problems is because the federal government is lightening the burden of the takers right now. And the takers want more. And as long as they can continue to take and take more until the system breaks. This is, and as a matter of fact, what is it, Cliven Piven, or how do I pronounce that, Sean?
Cloward Piven.
Cloward Piven, thank you.
I think another aspect of that that is really important, and I think this is what happens with the cultural side of it. Because like you're talking about and illustrating how they have all the takers and leeches and people living off the government, and they've manipulated things to where people give up and decide, okay, I might as well be independent. I think the bigger part of that and what's going on in Minnesota, and now they're exposing it in California and other places, is this systematic process of fraud, where the federal government is using money and funds to the states to manipulate people for their purpose of power and control. And then that's being corrupted and kicked back to the people who are in charge of it. Because most of the fraud that's going on isn't people that are poor, destitute, and need services and don't have means for themselves. Most of the fraud is systemic corruption, like a business. I mean, I've seen multiple videos of just one person, and there's other people doing it at the same time, where they'll go to an abandoned motel, and every single room that used to be a motel room is now a hospice office or a daycare. They're not providing services to anyone. It's all fraud.
Yeah. Right.
And the politicians that manage and the bureaucrats that manage the system are profiting off of it and benefiting off of it, even if it's not directly, personally in their checking account. They're benefiting by having the money directed to organizations that help them keep power and control to just keep growing the system.
Right. Keep growing and growing until it collapses.
Right, exactly. Cloward Piven. And they're coming at that from every different aspect of our society. Culturally, legally, the benefits, the way they're designing the cities and services.
Yep.
And the marketing.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting more and more focused towards that.
But the problem that they're facing, that as long as they can get away with the way that they're doing it, they will succeed. But the true problem is shining the light on what? Shining the light on the fact that they have no legitimate authority to be doing these things.
Exactly.
Folks, the complexity of the Constitution, as far as I'm concerned, is so simple that it basically, you know, I'll just say it boggles the mind how simple it is. If the power is not delegated, they can't do it. Why are we having a problem with allowing them to continue doing things they have no authority to do? The day America gets illiterate and stands up, and every time government looks in a direction that they have no business looking, stop. Don't even look over there because you don't have any authority to be going there. Now, all of a sudden, we've taken control of our government. This is the power that the divine hand of providence has given we, the people, and our governments, our county governments, our state governments. And as a matter of fact, we've gone through this time and time again. Who is it that's legitimately supposed to be, you know, basically manhandling and haranguing the federal government into making sure that it's not going outside these bounds?
The states.
The state legislatures. And the state legislatures are going well outside their bounds. And who is it supposed to be keeping them from going outside their bounds?
The counties.
The county legislatures, folks. So if you don't start understanding, it's we, the people, that have to get our county legislatures to actually start standing up to that state legislature saying, hey, you know what, we're done with you. You know, we've all been kind of pulled into this cloud of obscurity that the parties and you know, as long as you all agree, you can do anything. No. If it is not enumerated in that Constitution, you can't be doing it anymore, and we're shutting you down. That's the power of the people. That's the power of the Constitutions. Go ahead. Go ahead, Tammy.
When you say county legislators, do you mean commissioners?
Yep.
What do you mean?
Yes. Supervisors in some counties and states. They call them commissioners in some. And I think they're supervisors in parishes, too. Correct, Sean?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so see? Louisiana, which is the outlier, because they don't have counties, they have parishes. They have legislatures at that level as well. And they came into the constitutional republic under the same design or under the same auspices by the Enabling Act for the parishes to actually assemble delegates to go into a convention to create the state of Louisiana and its constitution. Go read the Enabling Act for the state of Louisiana. It's out there. The parties to that compact are the parish legislators. This is the common thread. And even though the federal government started breaking away from this much later on, it was too late. Because now we can see that the reason they broke away from it was because they started to create this, I'll call it, this question of who's really in control out at the state level. Most of the many Western states, after the Dillon Rule and after some of this crap where the federal government, this all happened post-Civil War. But the reality is when we read the authority given to the federal government in Article 4, Section 3, in admitting new states into the Union, they had no authority to actually go into details of how that state is to be erected. In other words, they didn't have the authority to create that state in the way that we're being told. The states were to be created because the fundamental tenet of our government, as declared in the Declaration of Independence, is our governments are instituted by men, or we the people. And therefore, the first government we were supposed to institute was that parish and county government. But the federal government did it for us. And then they started creating states for us. And then they just said, you know what? We're the overarching gods of government. We are the supreme being of your government and law. And whatever we say, you have to abide by it, because we're going to give you money for it. So it's, you know, when you really start backing up, it really, I think it's so simple, folks. What's so hard about this? Please let me know. Maybe there's just another way it needs to be said as we kind of look at what we're walking around to identify whether that's a garage, a woodshed, a kitchen, You know, there are things that are standing out that clearly dictate to what it is. It's a limited and defined government, and it's your county government. And the problem with your county government is you failed to institute it, to create a constitutional county and to actually get this foundation of our constitutional republic correct to be healthy again, to be healthy for the first time ever. We need to institute constitutions for our counties, because whether we like it or not, government has gotten so intrusive in our lives, it is managing everything. And if we actually follow the foundational documents and what we're supposed to do in living in a government array in this hybrid constitutional republic, we are to institute those constitutions to delegate the power to that government we are creating or instituting. Therefore, that's why we institute both the government as well as the constitution for that government. And that's where the government gets its authority. They just don't, we don't, you know, hey, go create yourself and then tell us how you want to rule us. I mean, the framers weren't that stupid, but Americans today sure are. Isn't it amazing? Anyway, let's get back to where we are with, and we got about 2 minutes. Let's get back into this. So, Hamilton, we're all kind of on the same point. So, Tammy, why don't you read what Hamilton said at this point? Go ahead.
Okay. Colonel Hamilton was in general against embarrassing the government. The government? Yeah, with minute restrictions. There was, on one side, the possible danger that had been suggested. On the other side, the advantage of encouraging foreigners was obvious and admitted. Persons in Europe of moderate fortunes will be fond of coming here, where they will be on a level with the first citizens. He moved that the section be so altered as to require merely citizenship and inhabitancy. The right of determining the rule of naturalization will then leave a discretion to the legislature on this subject, which will answer every purpose.
And interestingly enough, what Hamilton was saying was the best thing to say. Basically, to make sure that we didn't create these classes when people moved to the United States, if they had money and they had holdings and so forth, that they would instantly become citizens or be on a fast track where the poor would not be. He wanted to make sure that those who were coming here would actually become at the same level. As he says here, persons in Europe of moderate fortunes would be fond of coming here where they will be on the level of the first citizens. He moved that the section be so altered as to require merely citizenship and inhabitancy, not a level of affluence or money or property. That the right of determining the rule of naturalization will then leave a discretion to Congress. He says the legislature on this subject, but he's talking about Congress. And that's what actually ends up in the Constitution, that the federal government has no control over immigration and how the states want to create inhabitants and so forth. The federal government will actually create the standards for citizenship in a rule of naturalization so that there will be a uniform rule throughout all of the states, because the states are managing their own immigration process. So it only lends to sense, it's just common sense, that the states would actually be involved and responsible for admitting these inhabitants to become citizens of the United States. The federal government doesn't need this huge bureaucracy of INS to actually say, yeah, you're ready. All they needed to do was create a uniform rule of naturalization, and the burden would be placed on the states to ensure that the inhabitants, or I should say these immigrants, would have a level of learning, understanding, speak English, be able to write, understand the laws, pass a test, that it would all be uniform throughout the states. Not a financial burden at the federal level, but a fundamental burden for the states, because they were the ones bringing the immigrants in. They were the ones gaining from having immigration coming into their states and land and so forth. So We'll be right back with Madison right after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so with that, now Mr. Madison is going to pipe up, and he seconds the motion that has been moved to insert 9 years instead of seven, which is what Mr. Williamson proposed, right? I mean, Hamilton, and at this point you can actually see, here is a direct result where Madison is not a sycophant, or these two guys aren't completely aligned with the way of thinking. But let's go ahead, Sean, and let's read Mr. Madison's comment.
Mr. Madison seconded the motion. He wished to maintain the character of liberality which had been professed in all the Constitution and publications of America. He wished to invite foreigners of merit and republican principles among us. America was indebted to immigration for settlement and prosperity. That part of America which had encouraged them most had advanced most rapidly in population, agriculture, and the arts. There was a possible danger, he admitted, that men with foreign predilections might obtain appointments, but it was by no means probable that it would happen in any dangerous degree. For the same reason that they would be attached to their native country, our own people would prefer natives of this country to them. Experience proved this to be the case. Instances were rare of a foreigner being elected by the people within any short space after his coming among us. If bribery was to be practiced by foreign powers, it would not be attempted among the electors, but among the elected, and among natives having full confidence of the people, not among strangers who would be regarded with a jealous eye.
So that's very interesting, because how many times have those of you who have been involved in elections, how many times have you uttered the words, they're really not a Wyomingite, they're really not a Californian, they're not a Washingtonian, they're not a Louisianian. There's actually, what's the term for Louisianite? Is it, Sean, what do you call a person from Louisiana?
Coonass.
What's that?
A coonass.
Okay. So, but
no, I'm just kidding.
That's, yeah, I get it. I could look it up because I know there's a term for every state.
I'm not sure what it is.
Yeah, that's fine. You would think that in some states like Hawaiian, it wouldn't be Hawaiian, and it would be maybe a Hawaiianite. But even that sounds funny. Regardless of how it sounds, Washingtonian, or I think it's Wyomingite, right, Tammy?
Yeah, that's okay. What I say.
Okay, so when a Wyomingite is looking and they're speaking out against the different candidates, boy, they really quickly jump onto, this person is an implant. This person's only been here 5 years. They don't know our culture. They don't know our ways.
Yeah, they do that.
Ah, even today we do that. Even today when somebody moves, if I move from Washington to, let's say, Wyoming, I would be challenged as somebody that would not understand the ways of Wyoming government as well as somebody that lived there. And I find that about as, that's tomfoolery, it's a paradox, it is a trap that people get into because we fail to really understand and grasp what's important when it comes to being, you know, choosing, when it comes to choosing who is going to represent you. This is why I believe if we started a long time ago in demanding and promoting a test on understanding the Constitution for every public servant, then it would be done. It would be over. I mean, no more, right?
I'd be for that.
Okay, so as we move down, we're going to make a jump now because it's a significant jump we're taking, and this is August 18th. And this is where we land on page 322. So it's a big jump. We go over, there's a lot of good stuff that they cover, folks. I would, you know, tell everybody to read these entire notes. There are things we're skipping because we don't want to spend a whole year in going through this entire document. We've got the ratifications to skim through as well. We're only trying to highlight these very specific things on the importance of the admission of states and how Congress has no control over those things. Remember, they already started saying that they were going to control their level of sovereignty, that they wouldn't be equal status, so forth. That was the paradigm that they had already created. And so this is also where they lay out the first time where patents ought to be included at the federal legislature or under the federal government instead of out at state governments, because it would alleviate a lot of legal wrangling between states. We invented it first. We invented it. All patents would then be subject to going to the federal government so that they're, you know, whatever landed there first is, you know, they get the patent on it instead of having states playing with their dates and tomfoolery. But anyway. Are we there?
Where?
Yep.
Are we on August 18th in convention, the admission of new states?
I am.
Okay. Well, I think it's your turn to read anyway, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Okay. So Mr. Madison, go ahead, and he kind of goes through.
All right.
There's all of these lines here, right? And so let's go ahead and read all of the red. And then we will actually have Sean read the blue in the militia, okay? All right. Thank you.
Mr. Madison submitted, in order to be referred to the Committee of Detail, the following powers as proper to be added to those of the General Legislature: to dispose of the unappropriated lands of the United States, to institute temporary governments for new states arising therein, to regulate affairs with the Indians as well within as without the limits of the United States, to exercise exclusively legislative authority at the seat of the general government and over a district around the same, not exceeding, it's just got a blank square miles, the consent of the legislature of the state of states compromising the same being first obtained, and to grant charters of incorporation in cases where the public good may require them and the authority of a single state may be incompetent.
Okay, so stop right there.
To secure.
So stop right there. That's kind of bold black and red. To grant charters, mm-hmm. that the federal government would be able to grant a charter of incorporations. Now, Madison stated during the Bank Act that, hey, the federal government was requested to actually, or it was stated that the federal government had the ability to create charters or incorporations. There's the line right there. This was brought up in the convention. It was rejected, and he points out that this concept of creating a charter for a corporation or a bank was rejected. They don't have the power. I mean, so he's making the suggestion. I find it ironic that Madison made the suggestion and then, you know, it getting turned down. Maybe that's why, as he was serving in office when this came up, he goes, hold on. It was my idea that the federal government had this power to do this, and it was rejected. Do you see my point of how, you know, most people probably wouldn't even remember that that even came up because, you know, he put it out there and it was just, you know, brushed aside. So what he's doing is he's looking at injecting these very specific lines within either Article 1, Section 8, and this is specifically Article 1, Section 8, but keep going with the literary to authors or copyrights for a limited time and so forth. Go on.
Okay, to secure to literary authors their copyrights for a limited time, to establish a university, to encourage by premiums and provisions the advancement of the useful knowledge and discoveries, to authorize the executive to procure and hold for the use of the U.S. landed property for the erection of forts, magazines, and other necessary buildings. These propositions were referred to the Committee of the Detail, which had prepared the report, and at the same time, the following, which were moved by Mr. Pinckney in both cases unanimously, to fix and permanently establish the seat of government of the U.S. in which they shall possess the exclusive right of soil and jurisdiction, to establish seminaries for the promotion of literature and the arts and sciences, to grant charters of incorporation, to grant patents for useful inventions, to secure authors' exclusive rights for a certain time. Is this repeating itself? Feels like it is.
It kind of is.
To establish public To establish public institutions, rewards, and immunities for the promotion of agriculture, commerce, trades, and manufactures, that funds which shall be appropriated for payment of public creditors shall not during the time of such appropriation be diverted or applied to any other purpose, and that the committee prepare a clause or clauses for restraining the legislature of the U.S. from establishing a perpetual revenue, to secure the payments of the public debt, to secure all creditors under the new Constitution from a violation of the public faith when pledged by the authority of the legislature, to grant letters of mark and reprisal, to regulate stages on the post roads.
Okay, so really quick. First off, the duplication was due to the fact that if you read up, these propositions were referred to the Committee of Detail, which had prepared the report, and at the same time, the following, which were moved by Pinckney in both cases unanimously, and then they went through, and which were removed, which were moved by Mr. Pinckney in both cases unanimously. So in other words, the duplication was adding because it came from two different directions in the convention. Does that make sense? That's why there was some duplication.
Yep.
Okay, so there were certain things that became highlights, but the one, and again, the very last part, is this idea of to grant charters of incorporation. So the duplicate idea was literally afloat there. And then to secure all creditors under the new Constitution from a violation of the public faith when pledged by the authority of the legislature. So from a violation of the public faith, in other words, under this new Constitution, that they were going to hold every public servant, every member of Congress accountable if they violated through their expenditures. Basically, it says to secure all creditors, right? So they're talking about the money and spending money and taking on debt, that from a violation of the public faith when pledged by the authority of the legislature. In other words, to hold them accountable. That got removed. Okay, so now there's the shift on the focus of the militia and what it's going to be in the Constitution, because right now in Article 1, Section 8, we know that the militia and the calling of the militia and so forth is a part of Article 1, Section 8. And so this is where Mason and they start debating and injecting this power and are controlling this power as well, creating reservations and so forth. So go ahead, Sean, and cover through these, what, four or five men that kind of speak up on the focus, the beginning focus of the militia. Here we are, a month before the Constitution's done. They're now starting to talk about the militia. And they're now starting to talk about the concept of the right to bear arms, right? Because that, right, the Second Amendment folks out there, they're talking about, oh, this is the most important thing to the people of the convention. Have you ever heard a Second Amendment person say it was the second most important thing that they put because that's why it's the Second Amendment? You've heard them try to, you know, peddle that idea, right? Either of you? Okay.
But it's not.
It's not. Absolutely it's not. Because when you really look at the amendments, there were the Second Amendment was technically the fourth, and there were a lot of rights secured in those first three amendments well before this. And to be here we have it now, the militia just now started to become this almost, we're finishing up. Now what do we need to do regarding security? Oh, well, let's now talk about the militia. I mean, it wasn't forgotten, but it definitely wasn't the first, second, or third thing. It's right here in the end of the convention where they said, okay, now how are we going to maintain national security in these things? So let's go ahead with Mr. Mason.
Mr. Mason introduced the subject of regulating the militia. He thought such a power necessary to be given to the general government. He hoped there would be no standing army in time of peace, unless it might be for a few garrisons. The militia ought, therefore, to be the more effectually prepared for the public defense. 13 states will never concur in anyone's system. If the disciplining of the militia be left in their hands, if they will not give up the power of the whole, they probably will over a part as a select militia. He moved as an addition to the proposition just referred to the Committee of Detail and to be referred in like manner a power to regulate the militia. Mr. Gary remarked that some provisions ought to be made in favor of public securities and something inserted concerning letters of marque, which he thought not included in the power of war. He proposed that these subjects should also go to a committee. Mr. Rutledge moved to refer a clause, quote, that funds appropriated to public creditors should not be diverted to other purposes. Hallelujah. Mr. Mason was much attached to the principle, but was afraid such a fetter might be dangerous in time of war. He suggested the necessity of preventing the danger of perpetual revenue, which must of necessity subvert the liberty of any country. If it be objected to on the principle of Mr. Rutledge's motion, that public credit may require perpetual provisions, that case might be accepted. It being declared that in other cases, no taxes should be laid for longer than a term of blank years, he considered the caution observed in Great Britain on this point as the palladium of the public liberty.
Okay, so now we're coming into this next section on some key assumptions. And so Mr. Rutledge, Mr. King, Mr. Mason, and so forth. So, Tammy, why don't you go ahead and read Mr. Rutledge's motion? Go ahead.
Mr. Rutledge's motion was referred. He then moved that a grand committee be appointed to consider the necessity and expediency of the United States assuming all the state debts. A regular settlement between the Union and the several states would never take place. The assumption would be just as the state debts were contracted in the common defense. It was necessary as the taxes on imports, the only sure source of revenue, were to be given up to the Union. It was politic, as by disburdening the people of the state, debts would conciliate them to the plan.
Okay, so King and Pinckney both seconded the motion, and so Mr. Mason... And so why don't you go ahead, Sean, and read Mr. Mason, Mr. Sherman, and Mr. Ellsworth's ideas. Go ahead.
Colonel Mason interposed a motion that the committee prepare a clause for restraining perpetual revenue, which was agreed to with no contest. Mr. Sherman thought it would be better to authorize the legislature to assume the state debts than to say positively it should be done. He considered the measure as just, and that it would have a good effect to say something about the matter. Mr. Ellsworth differed from Mr. Sherman. as far as the state debts ought in equity to be assumed, he could see that they might and would be so.
Okay. Guess what you just read? Okay, so during the Assumption Act, it was laid out that, hey, you know, it was brought up in the convention that the federal government would have the power to assume state debt. That's what they're talking about right here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so as we look at this, are we seeing this idea being injected into the Constitution? That's the whole point of what I'm saying here. Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Because Madison brings this up. It comes up during the debate of the Assumption Act that, hey, they talked about doing this as a part of the convention, you know, so we should be able to just do this. Ah, Madison says that's correct. The member remembers correctly. Guess who that member was? And it actually doesn't come up specifically in the debates by name, but it had to have been either Sherman or Ellsworth because they were the names that brought it up. And Sherman, I know, and I believe Ellsworth were both in the first Congress when they were talking and debating this. Right? Okay? Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yep.
So the point is that when we go through the I'll just call it these deviations or things that, you know, stand out when Congress was actually debating, the fact that these two ideas were presented, more importantly, were rejected. The language was never inserted that the federal government could assume the debt of states. Madison points this out. He says, yeah, it was brought up. It was brought up by the worthy member over there. But it didn't, you know, it wasn't passed. It didn't pass the muster. So let's keep going with Mr. Pinckney. Go ahead, Tammy, and read Mr. Pinckney and Mr. King, and then we'll go through the votes on this, and then we'll go back through the last part with Sean reading Gary, King, and Rutledge. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Pinckney observed that a great part of the state debts were of such a nature that although in points of policy and true equity they ought, yet would they not be viewed in the light of federal expenditures. Mr. King thought the matter of more consequence than Mr. Ellsworth seemed to do, and that it was well worthy of commitment. Besides the considerations of justice and policy which had been mentioned, it might be remarked that the state creditors, an active and formidable party, would otherwise be opposed to a plan which transferred to the Union the best resources of the states without transferring the state debts at the same time. The state creditors had generally been the strongest foes to the impost plan. The state debts probably were of greater amount than the federal. He would not say that it was practicable to consolidate the debts, but he thought it would be prudent to have the subject considered by a committee.
Okay, so
Mr. Rutledge's
motion. Yeah, so hold on a second.
Go ahead.
So now we've gotten Pinckney and King kind of moving forward that, yeah, this, we need to do this. This makes sense. The fact of the matter is when you really look at how Mr. King lays this out, what he's proposing is absolutely the same thing that Madison proposed at the very beginning in the Virginia plan, that the federal government have what is the greatest way to control a body, whether it be a body of people, a person, corporations, governments, is by controlling their money. And so In a roundabout way, they were actually saying, let the federal government be responsible for assuming our debt or controlling our expenditures, debt, and every, because once the government has that control, now they're going to control how you spend and what you spend. In other words, you've just invited them into full control and subjugation by federal regulation. Folks, there is this idea, this concoction, that people think that if we create a balanced budget amendment That would solve our financial problems. It would make them absolutely asinine and actually devalue the enumerated objects of the Constitution. How and why? Because it doesn't matter what they spend their money on. Right now, they can only spend their money on these things. We can stop everything that they're doing that they're spending on. Right now, we can do it. But now that we're going to create an amendment, then they can continue to spend money on whatever they want as long as it doesn't exceed a certain percentage of the GDP. In other words, this amendment would galvanize big government and whimsical spending and debt and become a huge permanent burden. Right now, we can get out from underneath this entire debt like that because it's all unconstitutional. We don't owe it. And the people that have created the debt or gave us that money were responsible to ensure that we could be held accountable. And we can't. We can't be held accountable. Not because we'd want to be maniacal about it, because the people that they were making that agreement, that contract with, in taking that debt on, never had the authority to receive that debt for the purposes of its spending. In other words, because they said, oh, we need this much to be able to operate all of these things, they didn't have the authority to operate. And so the lender should have said, hold on here, you're asking for money. You don't have the authority to spend, which became them complicit in giving us the money because they knew that this would be destroying us if we legitimized it. If we don't legitimize it, it destroys them financially, but this shows their culpability in undermining our republic by working with these deviants that have been spending money on things they have no authority to spend, which is basically trying to collapse us, as we talked about with the Cloward Piven. Is that correct? I got the names right that time?
That's correct, sir.
Okay. Does this all make sense now? So this is why this is so important. Because the concept was brought up, and at least Madison in the congressional debates laid it out and said, no, you're correct. That was brought up, that the federal government would be able to control the debt and the expenditures and so forth. But it never made it into the Constitution. And because of that, it can't assume those debts. So let's now go into the vote on this. Because if you look, how many ayes? So New Hampshire, no. Massachusetts, aye. Connecticut, aye. And New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania, no vote because they were divided. Delaware, no. Maryland, no. Virginia, aye. North Carolina, aye. South Carolina, aye. And Georgia, aye. So it passed in this first pass. They passed this on to actually include the ability to assume the debt. And somewhere down this road, we're out of time, somewhere down this road, they decide not to include it. Not to be able to include the assumption of that debt. And so the point is, when people start looking at something, that this might be a great opportunity, there's no doubt in my mind this probably piqued the interest of those who truly understood what they were doing and said, hold on here, you're just now subjugating the states to a federal government. What was, like we tried to do in the very first plan? Come on, let's wake up, folks. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.